Welcome to Under Lock and Key, news and commentary about prisons from the Revolutionary Anti-Imperialist League.
Prison populations may already be skyrocketing, but states are finding new ways to reincarcerate prisoners after their sentences are up.
Amir Abu-Jamal writes about ineffective defense attorneys.
Supreme Court protects warrantless searches, and American cops single out oppressed nationals.
The U.S. incarcerates a greater percentage of its population than any other country, sending more black men to prison than to college. The purpose of this program is to educate about and inspire activism against the American lockdown.
At the end of May, the Minnesota Supreme Court ruled in favor of the Sexually Dangerous Persons Act, a legislative amendment allowing the state to commit so-called sex offenders in state hospitals after their prison sentence ends. It is up to the discretion of state-employed psychologists and caseworkers to determine whether or not a person is dangerous enough to warrant gaining what is obviously an extended prison sentence by another name. The Minnesota court ruled that the act does not violate due process under either the United States or Minnesota constitutions. This reactionary decision follows an April move by Missouri's House of Representatives to pass a bill that allows the Attorney General's office to review the cases of violent sexual offenders who have already been freed and have them recommitted. If recommitted, they would be incarcerated within state prisons in treatment programs run by the State Department of Mental Health. Laws surrounding sex offenders are ostensibly based on evidence of disproportionate recidivism for these crimes and the heinousness of sexually abusing children. But using Justice Department statistics, the National Center on Institutions and Alternatives points out that persons convicted of sex offenses have lower rates of recidivism than other crimes. And children, who these laws are supposed to protect, are at much greater risk of sexual abuse from family members than from strangers in their neighborhoods. The majority of the offenders, especially if they are white and protected by middle-class, unrestrained parental power, are never caught. The patriarchal family and an imperialist culture that sexualizes children and eroticizes power is the real danger the public should be notified about. The first state to enact legislation committing sex offenders past their prison sentences was Washington in 1990. Throughout the decade, other states have adopted similar measures. The U.S. Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality of indefinite civil commitment of sex offenders in 1997 in Kansas v. Hendricks, if it was for the purpose of treatment. Currently, at least 18 states have such laws. Other state laws literally make it impossible for freed sex offenders to leave prison at all. So-called community notification laws, which force convicted sex offenders to register with the police, have their names publicized in neighborhoods, school districts, and increasingly on the internet, make it impossible to find safe housing. If landlords will even agree to rent, notified communities can quickly become lynch mobs. We read recently of a Wisconsin prisoner still living in prison after his release date because no landlord would rent him an apartment. Civil libertarians like the ACLU correctly oppose sex offender registries and post-incarceration confinement as violations of due process of law, and said that they open the door for the state to air and publicize all past criminal acts in public. MIM further opposes the psychologizing of gender oppression inherent in sex offender-specific laws mandating treatment and empowering psychologists to extend prison sentences in hospitals. Such treatment, incorrectly based on the individual and not on the social ill of child sexual abuse, is also used as a tool of lifelong state supervision and surveillance. In a 1996 MIM Notes article, we wrote about the proliferation of Megan's Laws requiring sex offenders to register with the state. The article concluded, "All of this legislating and posturing will not stop the abuse of children, a group highly sexualized in this society. In a culture in which power is eroticized, children are common victims of sexual violence since they are the most powerless group in society. This sexualization of children is obvious in pornography and general media representation. The sex offender scare tactics reinforce incorrect analyses of rape, including rape of children. This use of gender to beef up the police state is a trademark of pseudo-feminism. Pseudo-feminists make gender the principal contradiction and ignore the ramifications of legislation they advocate has for oppressed national minorities. If you want to stop crime, rape, and child abuse, there is only one answer. It's not more police in prisons. It's a revolution to transform society." Mumia Abu-Jamal is a former Black Panther on death row in Pennsylvania. He was framed and put on death row because of his outspoken exposure of oppression of black people. Next, we will play an introduction by Judy Berry and then a commentary by Mumia Abu-Jamal. Judy Berry, an Earth First activist who was critically injured in a 1990 FBI bombing of the car she was driving in, died in 1997.
One of the things that Mumia has overcome is the incredible dehumanization as the system attempts to execute his spirit in preparation for executing his and other prisoners' bodies. For 12 years, Mumia has not touched another human being. He's not allowed contact visits. And he survived this with, as he would say, his aura of resistance intact.
In a case known as Strickland v. Washington, the U.S. Supreme Court drastically narrowed the range of challenges to the effectiveness and competence of counsel at criminal trials. The Sixth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution provides a right in all criminal cases to assistance of counsel. The Sixth Amendment notwithstanding, are people facing imprisonment and severe punishments actually receiving effective and competent assistance of counsel? You decide. If your lawyer actually went to sleep during your trial, would you think he or she was effective? This is what an appeals court ruled in a case called People v. Tippins, 1991. Although defense counsel slept during portions of the trial, the opinion read, counsel provided defendant meaningful representations. What about if your lawyer was high on drugs during the trial? When an appellate court was faced with just such an instance in the case known as People v. Badia, 1990, this was their learned analysis, quote, proof of a defense counsel's use of narcotics during a trial does not amount to a per se violation of constitutional right to effective counsel, unquote. Note, in this case, counsel admitted using heroin and cocaine throughout the trial. And in the case Commonwealth v. Africa, specifically involving MOVE political prisoner Mike Africa, the trial lawyer later admitted to daily cocaine and marijuana use, but that issue wasn't raised on appeal. It would seem that a fairly competent lawyer, having researched the evidence, would pay some attention to how his client was dressed at trial. Not so, said a court of appeals in a case known as People v. Murphy, 1983. Quote, counsel's seeming indifference to defendant's attire, though defendant was wearing the same sweatshirt and footwear in court that he wore on the day of the crime, did not constitute ineffective assistance, unquote. In all of these real cases, the attorneys involved were deemed competent in their representations, and their client's convictions were upheld. Under these cases, counsel means little more than presence by a lawyer at trial. For even if he is asleep, even if he or she is a drug addict, indeed high at the trial itself, it ain't no thing. Counsel, under Strickland's tortured logic, is presumed effective. This is just a few of the many cases from across the United States that show the poverty of the Sixth Amendment. For more information, you can read Effective Assistance Isn't Much, an article by Roger Darloff in the January-February issue of The American Lawyer. Increasingly, the amendments to the U.S. Constitution are merely filler for dusty history books which have no application in real life, as the courts have shown repeatedly. From death row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Widespread exposure of racial profiling by police, the Supreme Court ruled in early April to expand warrantless searches and traffic stops. The ruling means that passengers and their property can be subject to warrantless searches and routine traffic stops if the police find probable cause to search the car based on suspicion of the driver. Even with the extensive powers previously available to police to search a driver's car without a warrant, Supreme Court has, quote, never before permitted the search of personal items of a passenger who is suspected of no wrongdoing. This decision pounds one more nail in the coffin of the Fourth Amendment, which is supposed to protect against unreasonable searches and seizures. In January, the Supreme Court upheld the trial court conviction in Wyoming v. Houghton. This was a conviction of a woman whose purse was searched in a traffic stop based on police suspicion that the driver of the car had drugs. The Wyoming Supreme Court had earlier reversed that conviction. In its 6-3 decision, the U.S. Supreme Court wrote, quote, "Passengers, no less than drivers, possess a reduced expectation of privacy with regard to the property that they transport in cars. In contrast to the passengers' reduced privacy expectations, the governmental interest in effective law enforcement would be appreciably impaired without the ability to search the passengers' belongings, since an automobile's ready mobility creates the risk that evidence or contraband will be permanently lost while a warrant is obtained, since a passenger may have an interest in concealing evidence of wrongdoing in a common enterprise with the driver, and since a criminal might be able to hide contraband in a passenger's belongings as readily as in other containers in the car," end quote. The dissenting judges pointed out that by this ruling, police could apparently search a taxi passenger's briefcase if the officer had reason to believe the driver had hidden a syringe somewhere. The dissenting judges argue that the decision was an erosion of so-called privacy rights previously enjoyed by passengers in these situations. But it's not the erosion of privacy that should have revolutionaries concerned. Several states are now facing class-action lawsuits challenging racial profiling in traffic stops. This practice, discrimination against oppressed nation members, is rampant at every stage of the criminal injustice system. That it is being recognized in court as a particular problem in traffic stops is reason enough to expose the expansion of police power in these situations. New Jersey is among the states facing these lawsuits. Kevin Keenan of the New Jersey ACLU said, "These are black professionals. These are black middle-class people. They are stopped when they are going 5 miles over the speed limit or have other minor infractions, or they are stopped for no reason at all and repeatedly." Rail knows that the police stops are not restricted to the black petty bourgeoisie. Oppressed nation working class, lumpen, and youth are pulled over disproportionately without a legitimate traffic reason, and they are less likely to be able to find adequate legal representation. In February and April of this year, studies showed that for separate 2-month periods in 1997, 3 of every 4 drivers arrested on the New Jersey Turnpike were black or Hispanic. And in classic good cop, bad cop maneuver, as the High Court expands the power of the state to search passengers, the other branches of the government make noise about investigating the problem of racial profiling in traffic and transit. But as the governor of New Jersey recently showed in a press conference acknowledging the use of racial profiling, the investigations will focus on the individual bad cops that make the rest of the force look bad. The Department of Justice's Civil Rights Division is now investigating cases of racial profiling in New Jersey, Michigan, and Florida. Attorney General Janet Reno is calling for more data about whether such practices exist, and the U.S. Customs Service has announced an independent commission to review how its agents at international airports process passengers and whether they have singled out a disproportionate number of racial minorities for searches. The Revolutionary Anti-Imperialist League organizes against the injustice system as it is one of the most ferocious tools of national oppression. We build increasing opposition to the prison system in particular because of its severity in America, but we recognize that prisons exist as one stage in a thoroughly rigged process of national oppression. We call on all progressive forces to oppose this latest expansion of police powers as RAIL continues to build revolutionary forces to take down the entire American system of injustice.
This has been Under Lock and Key, a Revolutionary Anti-Imperialist League program about prisons. For more information, contact RAIL, P.O. Box 712, Amherst, Massachusetts 01004, or email railradio@min.org.